Okay, I want to speak about Pesach, and I want to explain one pasuk. That's it. Ba'avur zeh also Hashem li b'tzeisi mitzrayim. And that pasuk will give a very good perspective on what you're supposed to accomplish at the Seder. On the surface, that pasuk tells me that b'chol dor b'dor chayiv adam liro sasatzmo ke'ilu hu yotza mimitzrayim, she'ne'emar b'avur zeh aso Hashem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim. That seemingly the purpose of the Seder is that you should feel like you were a slave in Egypt and went out. How many of you at any Seder you've ever been at the end of the Seder, felt like you were a slave and came out of Egypt? I didn't think so. I've asked this question to thousands, literally, if not 10,000s of people all over the world, and nobody's ever raised their hand. My wife says every year she feels like she's a slave in Egypt. She hasn't yet felt like she went out. But that's not because of the Seder. That's for different reasons. So, what does that mean? That the mitzvah can't be done, maybe by only great people or whatever? So the way I'm going to explain it to you, you may not feel as depressed and disappointed at the end of the Seder this year than maybe you have at past years, when you really understand what you're supposed to accomplish and how to do that. This pasuk appears in the Haggadah four times. The first time as the answer to the Rasha. Rasha mahu omer, moha avodah zos lachem, what's all of this to you? Fisha hotzi esatzman aklal, kofar be'ikr, because he took himself out of the general rule, right? He said, lachem, what's all of this to you? So he's kofar be'ikr, which we'll understand what that means. Seemingly he denies God. The afata hake eshino ve'emerlo, and therefore you set his teeth on edge. And tell him, Bavur Zel Asar Hashem Li, B'tzeisi Mitzrayim, this is what God did for me when I left Mitzrayim, leave alone, me and not him. Had he been there, he wouldn't have been taken out. So the first place this pasuk appears is as the answer to the Russian. Right after that, it appears again. The She'eni Odeh Lishol, the child who doesn't know how to ask, At Psachlo, you open up to him. She'ne'emar, he got it to Levincho Bayom Ahulemor, you should tell your child that night saying, or that day saying, Bavur Zah, so Hashem Li, B'tzeisi Mitzrayim. This is what God did for me when I left Mitzrayim. Same exact answer. Very strange that we use the same exact pasuk to answer the Rasha and the Eni Yodeh Lishol. It's even more strange if you look in the Chumash, it's not like that. The answer the Torah says to the Rasha is not that pasuk. In the Torah it says like this, Ki yomru aleichem b'neichem mo avod azos lachem. When your children will say to you, what's all of this to you? V'amartem zevach pesach hu l'Hashem. You should say that this is a Passover sacrifice to God who passed over the houses of our ancestors in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, and the people bowed and thanked God. So it's a different pasuk completely, and the Haggadah doesn't even mention it. The Haggadah takes the answer that you're supposed to give the one who doesn't ask, and it duplicates it and says it for the Rasha too. What? Says the Vilna Gaon. The truth is, the Torah didn't give any answer to the Rasha directly, because the Rasha doesn't ask any question. By the other two sons, the Chacham and the Tam, it says, Ki yisholcha bincha. Your son will ask. Here it says, Ki yomru aleichem. He'll tell you. This Rasha is not asking a question. What's all of this to you? He's challenging you. He's making a statement. What's all of this to you? You don't answer a challenge. So the Torah says, V'amartem, you should say something, not to him. The other two children, it says, V'amarta levincha, say to your son. V'amarta elav, say to him. Here it doesn't say to him, it says, V'amartem, you should say. Your challenge, somebody question, what's all of this worth? Speak to yourself and strengthen yourself. V'amartem zevach pesach uvashem. Don't speak to him. Don't answer him. He's attacking you. You don't answer an attack. But the Mechilta says when you speak to the Eni Yodeh Lishol and you give him his answer, Bavur Zah, so Hashem Li, Kan Ramas Tshuva Leben Rasha. Here the Torah hints an answer to the Rasha indirectly. When you speak to the Eni Yodeh Lishol and you say, this is what God did for me, you say to him, you see me, but not him. You see that rush over there? Had he been there, he wouldn't have been taken out. You're obviously not talking to him. Because if you're talking to him, it would say, leave alo lecha, me and not you. But it says, me and not him. So you're talking about him to a third person. So the Vilna Gaon says, when you answer the Emil de Lishol with his answer, you tell him, me and not him. Had he had been there, you wouldn't have been taken out. That's the Vilna Gaon. So we have two already, two places where it says, Bavur Zeh Asa Hashem Li. One as the direct answer to the Emil de Lishol, and as the Vilna Gaon says, we use that answer also to hint an answer to the Rasha indirectly. My question is, if you had to pick one of the children at the Seder to use as a vehicle to get back at the Rasha, I wouldn't have chosen the Emil de Lishol. This kid has enough problems as it is. I don't know what's going on. I would have said, use the Chacham, use the Tam, but not the Emil de Lishol. So why did the Torah say, when you answer the Emi or Daily Shol, and you start to open him up, hint to him the answer to the Rasha? Why get him all mixed up? Why confuse him? That's my question. In order to answer that, we're going to need a lengthy Hakdama, and then we'll have understood at least three of the places where the Haggadah says Bavur Zeh, and then we'll only have the fourth one to go to. The Torah demands that we remember Yetzias Mitzrayim minimum of about 1,000 times a year. Twice every day in Shema is a mitzvah, Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, day and night, and Shabbos, Yom Tov, Tefillin, Bechoros, a host of mitzvahs are remembrance of Yetzias Mitzrayim. If you add it all up, it adds to about 1,000 times a year. How feeble-minded did God think we were that if we didn't remember Yetzias Mitzrayim 1,000 times a year, we'd forget it? Why 1,000 times a year? The answer is that Yetzias Mitzrayim, which includes the 10 plagues, the Exodus, the splitting of the Red Sea, the giving of the Torah, is the foundation of our faith and makes it different than all other religions. Take the other two major religions in the world, Christianity and Islam. On the surface, it would seem that we believe what we believe because our parents, our teachers told us, the previous generation told us, what they got from the generation before them, all the way back to the people who actually experienced it. So, because we're born Jewish, we hear the Jewish story. If we would have been born Christians, we would have heard the Christian story. Parents would have told us about Yashka and what Christians are supposed to believe in. Why? Because their parents told them, all the way back to the people who experienced it. And the same thing with Islam. So it's just an accident of birth that we believe in Judaism. Because if we'd been born another religion, we'd believe in that. And they all have a tradition, right, that's passed on from generation to generation. Is there any significant difference between them? Says the Khuzri, there's a tremendous significant difference. Yeah. I know that I'm supposed to believe in certain things because my parents told me that they got it from their parents. But if you trace it back to its source, right, and the same thing with Christians, same thing with Muslims, if you trace them back to their source, there's a tremendous difference of what the foundation, the source is of each of these religions. Let's say Christianity. What is the foundations of Christianity? Not the details. Foundation. That Yashka was the Son of God, and that he died for the sins of mankind and was resurrected, came back to life. Those are the two major foundations of Christianity. Okay, so if you're a Christian, you believe that because your parents told you, and their parents told them. But how did it get started? Who started this idea that Yeshua was the Son of God? So let's assume that he said it. Right? He claimed to be the Son of God. Did anybody witness that God signed the birth certificate? No. Did anybody see that God gave out cigars when he was born? No. So how do you know for sure he was the Son of God? Because he said so. So the whole foundation is what he claimed to be. Nothing more. Just his word. Right? No proof. He claimed to be the Son of God. How about his resurrection from the dead? How many people witnessed that? So the New Testament says a small group of his closest disciples, who definitely were not objective, but very subjective, they had a reason to say that he came back, because if he didn't, they were out of a job. So small group of his disciples and a group of swooning women, fainting women. Now, not to impugn the credibility of women, but fainting women, right? When you're fainting, you can see anything. So that is the whole foundation of Christianity, of the foundation of the resurrection, that he came resurrected from the dead, a small group of people who had a reason to say what they said, right? And a bunch of women who were fainting. That's going to them. That's who witnessed it. Very shaky foundation. Islam has an even more shaky foundation. The whole foundation of Islam is that Muhammad had a dream one night in a cave, that the angel Gabriel came to him, revealed to him the religion of Islam and the Quran. That's it. Now, nobody videoed the dream. Nobody shared the dream. Maybe Muhammad had a dream. Maybe he had a stomachache and he had a nightmare that night. Right? Anything's possible, but it's the word of one person. Now, Muhammad had a very cogent philosophical argument that convinced a lot of people to accept his religion. It went something like this: accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that to be extremely convincing. The Rambam says that God wanted these religions to be successful. He wanted them to spread. It's not the time now to discuss why, but that's obviously they were successful. But if the foundation of these religions, very, very shaky. Very, not very credible. It's just the word of one person or the word of a very few select group of people who claim they saw everything or they were something or they heard something or whatever. Now, if our religion would have been the same, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam catch up with the Jewish people who are settled in Tel Aviv and they tell them, you got to hear what happened to us. We were backpacking through the Middle East. And we got captured in Egypt as slaves. And we were working very hard. And one day God brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians, got us out of there. When we came out, the sea split for us and we went through. Then we went to Har Sinai and we got the Torah. And here it is. And believe us, we saw all these things. So our religion will be the same as theirs. Basically based on the testimony of a few people of what they saw, what they experienced, or whatever. But that's not what supposedly happened. Our religion started with Moshe coming and telling the Jewish people, all of you saw this. You all were slaves in Egypt. You all saw the 10 plagues. You all get out of Egypt. You all went through the Red Sea. You all heard God speak at Har Sinai. So supposedly, it happened in front of an entire nation. Now, there are only 5 possibilities of how that tradition got to us. That my parents told me all these things because their parents told them. So where did it start? How did it get started? One possibility is it really happened. And the people who witnessed it passed it on to the next generation and so on. And I heard it from my parents who heard it from their parents all the way back. That's one possibility. There are 4 other possibilities. And the other 4 possibilities are very improbable. Let's see what they are. First possibility. Moshe Rabbeinu came to the people at the time and convinced them they saw all these things when they didn't. It never happened. But Moshe was very charismatic, and he hypnotized an entire nation and made them believe they saw things they didn't see. Very improbable. Now, I could have come here tonight, white as a sheet, shaking, almost impossible to speak, and tell you, I know you're going to think I'm crazy. I know you're not going to believe me, but I have to get this off my chest. I got to tell you what happened on the way here. On the way here, I was on the highway. There weren't any other cars around. And all of a sudden, the flying saucer landed on my car. 10 little green men got out, danced around my car, got back in the flying saucer and took off. And I'm still shaking. Now, some of you may at least entertain a doubt that maybe it happened. I mean, I haven't never said anything like that before. I have no reason to want to fool you. So maybe it happened. At least you have a doubt. Maybe it really happened. Or maybe I was hallucinating. Or maybe I thought I saw something else. But you at least consider it. But if I would have come here tonight and say, remember 2 weeks ago, we were sitting here in the middle of the shir, you all were here, and a flying saucer came through that door, landed up here, 10 little green men got out and danced around us, and then they got back in and took off. Don't you remember that? Would anybody here who was here 2 weeks ago have a doubt that it happened? And if any of you would have had a doubt, right, not all of you, I hope not, I could convince you that I saw something I didn't see, but very, very improbable that I can convince you that you saw something you didn't see. And we're talking about Jews. It's hard enough to convince Jews they saw what they did see, let alone what they didn't see. And the Rav Shamshon Paul Hirsch says one of the biggest proofs the Torah is true, that we accepted it, because we are very stubborn people. So that's very improbable that Moshe Rabbeinu could have convinced the entire nation that they saw things they didn't see, and they began this tradition because Moshe said so. We saw it. Okay, we accept that. That's improbable. Second possibility. Never happened. And the people got together and made a hoax. They made it up. They said they saw it when they know they didn't see it. And they gave it to their children. Why? Because they were slaves in Egypt, and that wasn't such a great history, and they wanted to create a nice heritage for their children and make them proud. So God took us out of Egypt, and he split the Red Sea, and he gave us a Torah. Now, that may be, but tacked onto this tradition was a Torah with a lot of laws that were completely against the mores of the time. For instance, in Egypt it was accepted to marry your relatives. Incest was an accepted thing. Even the Torah says that people were crying because they had to get rid of their spouses who were relatives. Moshe Rabbeinu's mother married her nephew, right? Because he was the aunt of Amram. So what's it called? That was uncommon, and Moshe came along and told them you can't do that. So they all made up something, right, that harmed their children. Made up all these laws, and they know they weren't true. They just were made up. Why would they do that to their children, right? If I thought that somebody 3,000 years ago made up that I should put little black boxes on my arm and my head and get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do it, I would never do it. I only do it because I believe that God said to do it, and it makes a big difference to my eternity. But if I thought that somebody made it up, I never would do it. So here are parents who know there's nothing to putting these little black boxes on, tell their kids to do it, right? And they know that there's no purpose to it. And a lot of other halachas that are much more difficult. Why would they do such a thing? So yes, there can be abusive parents, but an entire nation. And usually people, before they die, feel guilty, and they call their kids in and say, listen, forget about the black boxes, forget about Yom Kippur, forget about pay. We made it all up. It didn't happen. So that's also improbable that it started with a hoax. Third possibility. Never happened. Nobody convinced the people at the time. They didn't make it up. 1,000 years later, somebody made it up. Ezra. It was a rainy day, nothing better to do. Made up the Torah. And he convinced the people in Babel that 1,000 years earlier, their ancestors saw all this. Also improbable. Because if it never happened, nobody could have heard of it. And if nobody heard of it, somebody's going to say, Ezra, how come nobody ever heard about this for 1,000 years and all of a sudden you discovered it? If it's really true, then how come for the last 1,000 years nobody heard of it? And again, if it was just to make a glorious history, okay. But he tacked on a lot of mitzvahs called the Torah, and part of that was getting rid of their non-Jewish spouses. Now, if they had any doubts, they weren't going to do this because Ezra said he discovered something that happened 1,000 years earlier that nobody ever heard of. Very improbable. The last possibility is the following. It never happened. Not the way the Torah said. But it happened. In a very innocent way. For instance, there were Jews working overtime in Egypt. Bad working conditions. They made a strike. They got out. As they were going out, they jumped over a puddle. And then they made up some laws. And 1,000 years later, after giving it over and over and over, like the guy who caught the sardine, after, 10 times telling it over, it becomes a whale. So things get changed. There's a game in America, they call it telephone. In England, they call it Chinese whispers. You have 10 people in line, and you tell the first person something, you say, pass it on. He passes it on, and by the time you get to the 10th person, it changed completely. So maybe that's what happened. It started with something very, very innocent, no big deal. And after telling it over for 1,000 years, it became Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamsuf and Esar Makos and Matan Torah. Change. Also very improbable. Why? Because imagine if you had 100 people playing telephone. 10 lines of 10 people. And the given is that your same message was given to all the people in the front of the line. We don't know what the message was. But whatever it was the same message. And we told them to pass it down. Then we get to the 10th people in line, and we ask them what they heard. And they all heard the same thing. Same message. Now, we don't know if that's the same message that started or not. Two possibilities. It is the same message that started, it didn't change, and it's the same thing. It started out the same, and it ended the same. Or no, it changed 10 times, independently the same way. Which is more probable? That it didn't change. But if it changed, there should have been 10 different versions, 8 different versions, not the same thing. So if everybody saw by Yetzias Mitzrayim the same thing, we don't know what it was, Pavel or Kriyas Yamsuf. But we know in the end there's only one Masoda. There never was another tradition. Even the Tzedukim, the Karoyim, the Reform, the Conservative, they don't have another tradition. They just don't believe in tradition. But they don't claim to have another one. There should have been 100 different traditions of Kriyas Yamsuf. Some people say the sea split. Some people say they went scuba diving. Some people say they built a bridge. Some people say they jumped over the thing. There should have been, it should have changed 100 different ways. Because we're talking about independent lines of tradition. But there's never been more than one tradition. So the fact that the tradition is one makes sense that it didn't change. How could it not change? Because the people giving it over knew they were giving over something that their life depended on. You had people not playing a game called telephone, but you had somebody having a fit, some kind a fit. And somebody is standing there, doesn't know what to do for him. There's a doctor 10 people away, and you can only speak to the person in front of you, and he can speak to the person in front of him. And you say, pass on to the doctor the symptoms of what's going on, and let him pass back what I should do. Do you think it would change? No. Because everybody knows somebody's life depends on it. So here, everybody knew this is not a game. It's serious. We believe that this tradition we're handing on, our lives depend on it. Our eternal lives. So they're careful. That shouldn't change. Yeah, there's arguments about details. But there never was a different opinion whether there was Kriyas Yamsuf or not Kriyas. And not only we believe in it. The Christians believe. The Muslims believe in it too. I once had a woman come to me. She wanted to convert. So I said to her, what religion are you and why aren't you happy with the religion you have? She said, I'm Catholic. And there's certain things that Catholicism preaches which I just can't swallow. So I thought she's talking about the fact that a man could be a god or a virgin birth. So I asked her, could you give me one example of something that Catholicism preaches that you can't accept? She said, yeah, the splitting of the Red Sea. I said, I hate to tell you this, but it wasn't the Catholics that went through the Red Sea, it was us. She said, you guys believe in that too? I said, yes. Yeah. And not only that, the Muslims also believe in it, so forget about Islam.
Is that a joke or true story? No, it's true.
The 100% true. Right. My stories are all true. Right. Rabbi Wine says, all my stories are true, just some of them haven't happened yet. Yeah. But all of mine have happened. I'm not that creative to create stories that will happen. Okay. It really happened. That was the end of that woman's gayers. In any case, so very improbable. So therefore, out of all the possibilities of how we receive this tradition, the one that's most probable of all of them is that it really happened. So the fact that it happened in front of an entire nation is very hard to falsify and to make up. I can make up what I say I am, what a few people saw, they said they saw. That's easy to make up. But it's hard to make up something that supposedly happened in front of a whole nation because there's only 5 possibilities of how I got that tradition, and 4 of them are very improbable. And the one that's probable is that it really happened. So our emunah is based on the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's why 1,000 times a year we bring it to mind, because it strengthens our emunah. And therefore, the whole purpose of this, why did God make such a big show to get us out of Egypt? Because he wanted to base our emunah on something strong. He wanted it to be real. And if we have that unbroken chain of tradition, how do I know it? Because my parents told me, or people from the previous generation, if not my parents, teachers, somebody from the previous generation. And how do they know? Because somebody from the previous generation told them. As long as there's an unbroken chain of tradition, it makes our emunah, our belief, our faith very, very strong. And therefore, it's the responsibility of every generation to create the next link in the chain. I received it from the previous generation, I have a responsibility to pass it over, pun intended, to the next generation. And they have a responsibility to receive it and pass it over to the next generation. And that is what Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is. The Torah says, L'man tesaper bo'ozne bincho ben bincho. Should tell it into the ears of your children and your grandchildren. And then you'll know that I'm God. It won't be just you believe it. It'll be something real to you. Because it's an unbroken chain from the people who actually were there. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, in his commentary to the Torah, Apirio, asks, if every father has to tell his son, what's a grandfather have to get involved? Why have to tell your grandson? He says, it doesn't mean you have to tell your grandson. It means you have to tell your son in such a way that he'll be capable and interested to tell his son. Because you're not just telling him a story. You're creating a link in that chain. And therefore, if you don't tell him in a way that he'll pass it on to the next generation, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. And that's why it says, I think, L'man tesaper bo'ozne bincha. You have to tell it to his ears. Why did the Torah have to tell me that? If he didn't tell me that, I would tell it to his big toe. Of course, tell it to his ears. Now, the idea is it has to be tailor-made to his ears. You have to give it according to his intellect and his personality. And that, the Ritva says, is why the Torah speaks about four different kinds of kids. To tell me that if you tell a wise son a story that's fit for a dull son, you're not Yosef. You're born to death. And if you tell a dull son a story that's fit for a wise son, it'll be over his head. You have to tailor-make the story to your child's intellect and his temperament. That's the mitzvah of Sipur. How bad much is that? That's the third place that this pasuk is in the Haggadah. Bavur zeh aso Hashem li, is b'chol dor v'dor chayiv adam lilos es atzmo, ke'ilu hu yotze Mitzrayim. In every generation, a person has to consider himself as if he went out of Egypt. Because it says, Bavur zeh aso Hashem li, but there's another pasuk right after that. Va'osanu hotzi misham. God took us out of there. Not only our forefathers, but us. Why do I need two sentences to tell me the same thing? The answer is they're not the same thing. One pasuk tells me I have to feel like I was one of the people who went out of Mitzrayim. I have to feel it's so real that I feel myself as part of that Yetzias Mitzrayim, part of the Exodus. But the first pasuk is something different. In every generation, a person has to consider as if he personally went out of Mitzrayim, not was one of those who went out, was the only one who went out. And if you don't pass it on, it's lost. It's like Holocaust survivors. If we don't get their testimony now, there's not going to be anybody left. They're the last ones left to give over this testimony. So a person has to consider Pesach night that he's the only person left. Nobody else is going to give this over. And if he doesn't give it over, then it's going to be lost. That's the responsibility. And somebody who refuses to accept that responsibility Pesach night, vis-a-vis Pesach is a Rasha. You can be a Rasha for something specific, even though you're not a Rasha in general. This child of the Seder, who's a Rasha, what's all of this to you? What's he doing at the Seder? Rishayim usually don't go to Seders. They go to a nightclub, they go to the beach. They don't come to a Seder if he's a real Rasha. He's at the Seder. What could a Rasha be? The answer is he's not a real Rasha. He's only a Rasha vis-a-vis the Seder. Where do we find such a thing? It says that somebody who throws his fingernails in the street is a Rasha. And a person who buries them is a Tzaddik. And a person who burns them is a Chassid. You're going to tell me that somebody who Shomer Shabbos, eats kosher, learns Torah, but he throws his fingernails in the street, on Rosh Hashanah he's going to be Nechtav and Nechtam La'alta L'mavis because he's a Rasha? Doesn't mean that. He's not a Rasha through and through. These are the, how you deal with fingernails, this is the Rasha way of dealing with fingernails. You can be a Rasha for one specific thing. When it comes to Pesach night, a child who says, I'll sit at the Seder, I'll eat matzah and maror, but I'm not interested, it's not my responsibility. It's yours. Nothing to do with me. I'm not accepting the responsibility to be a link in that chain. For Pesach, he's a Rasha. That's the idea. And the Mela, if you have a child at the Seder who's not participating, there could be two reasons. One is because he's an Eini Yodea Lishol, he doesn't know how to ask. He doesn't know what's going on. So then you answer him innocently, this is what God did for me. Ask me questions. I'll teach you whatever you need to know. But it's possible that he's an Eino Rotza Lishol. He doesn't want to ask. He knows, but he doesn't want to get involved. He's the same as the Rasha, except he's quiet. He doesn't challenge us. So therefore, the Torah said, when you answer this kid who's not participating, tell him simply, this is what God did for me when I came out of Egypt. You have questions you really don't know, ask me. But if you're not interested in being part of this, you see that Rasha over there? He also said he's not interested in being. And if he was there, he wouldn't have been taken out, and the same thing applies to you. So the reason we hint the answer to the Rasha by the Ein Yodei Lishaal is because maybe that Ein Yodei Lishaal is an Ein Rotzei Lishaal. So that is the first way of fulfilling this mitzvah of actually feeling like you were there intellectually by speaking about the Exodus, by understanding there's an unbroken chain of tradition. It makes it real to me. It makes it not like I feel like I was in Egypt, but I feel that it was real. That I believe 100% as if I was there, because I'm hearing it from people who heard it from people who actually were there. That's the first way of fulfilling it intellectually, by recounting it and knowing there's an unbroken chain. Secondly, the Shurei Das asks, if the purpose of the Seder was that you should mamish feel, like you were a slave in Egypt and went out that night, it's not geared for that. I mean, if somebody asked me to design a Seder whose purpose is that the people at the Seder at the end should feel like they were slaves in Egypt and went out that night, I wouldn't have designed it the way God did. My design would have been the following. The Shurei Das is a little bit different. He's a little bit more refined. But I'll tell you my way. I would make a Seder like this. Everybody has to invite 20 people to their Seder. You get to be the coordinator. The other 20 people, when they come, you divide them into two groups, Group A and Group B. The first quarter of the night, you give Group A whips and clubs, and you tell them to beat Group B while they build pyramids in your backyard. At a quarter of the night, you blow your whistle and you say, change. Let B beat A while they build pyramids. At midnight, you blow your whistle and you say, you're all free, no more building, no more beating, go home. I guarantee you the people of my Seder would feel like they were slaves in Egypt and set free that night. Much more than God's idea. What's God's idea of a Seder? I want to feel like you were a slave in Egypt. 210 years of persecution and bitterness and hard work, eat some lettuce. Right? Doesn't exactly catch the thing. My Seder would catch it more. The Shurei Das says, we should do like the Christians do on Easter. Make a passion play. Get everybody together. Have a play. There's Moshe. There's Aaron. We could even do better. We have a video with all 3D, with all of the special effects of Steven Spielberg, right? And it would mamash feel like you're there. You'd see the. I remember I was 10 years old, and Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments came out. I was in an afternoon Hebrew school in North Miami Beach. And they took us to see a premiere pre-showing of the Ten Commandments. And I remember as a 10-year-old, walking out of that movie theater and saying, if Cecil B. DeMille could split the Red Sea, then God could too. And my belief in Yetzias Mitzrayim was very much strengthened by that movie. Unfortunately, it wasn't exactly like the book. And unfortunately, whenever I think of Paro, I see Yul Brynner. And wherever I think of Moshe Rabbeinu, I see Charlton Heston. It's impossible to get out of your mind. But in any case, that is what we should do. Have a video with all the special effects. I guarantee that at the end of the night, you'll feel more like you were a slave in Egypt and went out than eating lettuce. So why did God make the Seder his way and expect it to accomplish what it doesn't seem to be able to accomplish? So I'm going to tell you what the Shurei Das says and couple it with something the Michtam Eliyahu says. Putting them together, they make a tremendous amount of impact and what really you're supposed to accomplish. Before I tell you what the Shurei Das says, I'm going to give you a marshal to what he says. In the 1950s, early 1960s, they used to have drive-in movies in America. You went with your car, you hooked yourself up to a speaker, and there's a gigantic screen, and people watched the movie from their car. Now, you could take as many people in the car as you wanted for one admission. So they didn't make their money on the admission. So what did they make their money on? Intermission. They sold popcorn and soda and candy, and that's where they made their money. So they wanted you to eat as much as you could. So originally, they used to have a little spiel before they had the intermission about how good the popcorn was and how much you should drink and how thirsty you are, whatever. Then they found something that was more effective. Instead of an advertisement, they had what's called subliminal advertising. They put in the movie a frame of very tempting popcorn. Eat popcorn, drink Coke. You didn't see it because it went by too fast, but it went directly into your subconscious, and they found that it was like a hypnotic suggestion, and people had this uncontrollable urge to drink Coke and eat popcorn. It's against the law to advertise like that in America. There's even people who say that the whole drug culture in America started that way, that the pop songs in the early 60s had a soundtrack that was not audible, but went into your subconscious when they were singing Puff the Magic Dragon. Over that, they were telling you to take drugs or whatever, and that's the hypnotic suggestion that started the drug culture. Okay, whether it's true or not is irrelevant. But what happens is you see that advertising that hits your conscious mind isn't as effective as something that goes directly to your subconscious. Says the Shurei Das, if we'd have a Seder like me, everybody get beaten, right? Or like him, that you'd have a play, it would make an impression, consciously, and it would wear off in a week, 2 weeks, you'd heal, and that would be the end. The Torah, God knew how to get to your neshama, very subtly. It has to bypass your external and go directly to your neshama. And by going to your neshama, it makes a greater impression and lasts a lot longer. Now, I want to add that, couple that with something else. Put them together, makes even more sense. The Michtam Eliyahu says that time is not a straight line, but it's like a spiral. The way I like to explain it is the following. Imagine 365 elevator shafts in a circle. These elevators are very unique, that the elevator doesn't just go up and down, but it goes around too. So the elevator starts on ground level, first shaft, which is called Aleph Tishrei. These elevator shafts are time zones. There are 365 time zones in the year. First day of the year, second day of the year, and that's how we go through time. The elevator started on ground level, the first day of Tishrei, man was created. The next day, man traveled to the next time zone called the second day of Tishrei, on ground level. Next day, the third day of Tishrei. Till he went through the whole circle and came back to the 29th day of Elul, and the next one was the first day of Tishrei again. But instead of going to ground level, went up one level, and now he's on level number one, again, in that same elevator shaft. What's beneath him? The creation, a year before. The memory of that creation of man, and all of the qualities that it created are in that elevator shaft, just a floor beneath. The elevator shaft is hollow. So when you go to floor number two, or floor number one, higher than ground level, you're passing through the memory of what happened the year before. It's there. It's permeated with that memory. We, last Tishrei, passed through the 5,771st floor of that elevator shaft. But beneath us was the memory of the creation of man. That's called Rosh Hashanah. We're going to pass through the 15th day of Nisan, which is another elevator shaft. That on the 2,448th level floor was the exodus of Egypt. The memory of that exodus is in that elevator shaft. And when we pass by quite a few floors higher, we pass through that memory which permeates the whole shaft. The only thing is you have to connect into it. You can't just pass through it. So it's like a computer. A computer has a memory, and you want to transfer that memory into another computer. So you need a cable that goes into the guts of the computer. You can't just tie the cable around the monitor and around the other monitor and expect what's in this one to go to the other one. It has to go from the guts of this one and transfer the electromagnetic impulses in the memory of this one to the memory of the other one. The cable doesn't have to look like what you're transferring. If you're transferring a database about mountain lions, the cable doesn't have to look like a mountain lion. But it has to be a certain configuration, certain amount of wires, certain amount of pins on each side, certain length of pin, configuration in a circle, in a square, and if it's not exact, it won't work. It won't plug in to this computer and that computer. It won't do the job. So you need a connection. You're passing through the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim through that time zone called the 15th of Nisan, that elevator shaft, where every year we come back to those same time zones, just a floor higher. And everything that's happened in that day, time zone, is in that shaft. You pass through it. You have to connect in. So you need a connector. The connector has to connect into your neshama and to the neshama of the time. Therefore, it has to be subtle. Those connectors are called matzah, morer, korban pesach. And the bedavka subtle, just like a cable. There's a few pins or whatever, but that's what makes the connection. Would anybody be so foolish to say, just get a cable, it doesn't make a difference how many pins or how big they are or what configuration they're in. Cable's a cable. No. If it's not exact, the exact amount of number of pins, the length of pin, and the configuration, it's not going to work. Same thing goes. People at the Seder say, why are you measuring the matzah and weight? Well, eat matzah. What difference does it make? How will you eat it? Reclining, not reclining, in 2 minutes, 10 minutes, just eat it. Right? Same thing. This has to make the connection. And if it's not eaten in the right amount of time, the right amount, in the right way, it's not going to make the connection. Just like the cable is not going to make the connection if it's not exactly the way it's supposed to be. So it is, yeah, it is important that you eat the right amount, in the right amount of time, in the right configuration, reclining, otherwise it's not going to work. It won't make the connection. But if you do it properly, then you've connected your neshama into the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim in that time zone, and it charges up your neshama, and the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim flows into your neshama for another year. You don't have to feel it. When you charge your car battery or your phone battery, right, or any other rechargeable batteries, you don't see the difference. Right? When you're charging, it doesn't start to glow, get bigger. If it does, run. Right? It just looks the same. Same exact battery before and after. But it's charged up. It works. You don't have to feel that your neshama feels differently. But it's charged up. If you give the mitzvahs properly, and you can end the Seder and say, Chasal, Sidr, Pesach, Kilchasu, I did it right, then you connected your neshama into the time zone, and the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim flowed into your neshama. It's charged up for another year. And that's the last place where it says, Bavur Zeh Asar Hashem Li, is Yochel Rosh Chodesh. I might think you could start this whole Seder on Rosh Chodesh. Tonight, last night, Talmud Lomar, Bavur Zeh, Bayomahu, has to be on that day. Has to be on that day, the day that it happened. Im Bayomahu, maybe you start in the daytime, not at night. Talmud Lomar, Bavur Zeh, has to be over Matzah and Morah. Bavur Zeh lo amarti el bizman sheish matzo mor munachim lefanecha. Bavur Zeh. You need the cable. You need the connector. The connectors have to be subtle. They have to get into your neshama, like the subliminal advertising. They can't affect just your externals, like tying the cable around your monitor. It has to get into the guts of the computer. And then it transfers the memory into your neshama, and it lasts for a whole year. You may not feel it. So we have intellectually, speaking about Yetzias Mitzrayim makes it real to you intellectually, and you feel it's real, not like you were a slave in Egypt personally, but that it really happened. You can really identify with it because I heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who was there. And I know that it was very hard to falsify that based on what we said. That's the first way. The second way is on a soul level, neshama level. I charge my neshama with the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim directly from the time zone where it is, where it exists, into my neshama. That's the second way. The third way is emotionally, and that is the following. It says in the Torah, "Umoshav b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim," the sojourn of the Jewish people in Egypt was 430 years. When they translated the Torah into Greek for Talmi HaMelech, they changed that. And they put in Mitzrayim and in other lands. Because we weren't in Mitzrayim 430 years. We were only in Mitzrayim 210 years. We couldn't have been there 430 years. We have enough information. We have enough information in the Torah to know that it couldn't have been. We know that Levi went into Mitzrayim his son Kahas and his son Amram were in Mitzrayim, and Moshe was 80 years old, their son, when he went out of Mitzrayim. If you add all their lives, end to end, right, consecutively, not concurrently like they were, that doesn't add to 430 years. We couldn't have been 430 years in Mitzrayim. The whole 430 years started from Bris Ben Abesorim. 30 years before Yitzchak was born, that's when the 430 years started. So, but Maisha says in the Torah, so they changed it and they added in Mitzrayim and other lands. But we have the Hebrew. It says in Mitzrayim. What do we do with it? It says we're in Mitzrayim, 430 years. What do we do with the Pasuk? The answer, I think, is, look at the end of the Pasuk. It says, Vayihi Mikeich, Shloshim Shona V'Arvan Hashona, at the end of 430 years, Yotzu B'nei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim. We left the land of Egypt. The beginning of the sentence doesn't say the land of Egypt. It says Egypt. The end of the sentence says the land of Egypt. Mitzrayim, Eretz Mitzrayim is a place. It's a geographic point on the globe. Mitzrayim is a state of being. We could be anywhere. Min ha-netzar karasi. Mitzrayim means you're tzekvetched, narrow. You are constricted, constrained. You can't express your essence. The essence of a Jew is to want to do God's will. But when you're in a state of Mitzrayim, you're narrow. You can't do that. What constrains you? The Yetzer Hara, Shibud Malchios, subjugation to others. In Mitzrayim, in Eretz Mitzrayim, those two things are the most intense. It was the most degenerate place in the world. The Yetzer Hara was strong, and we were under the thumb of the Egyptians. We were slaves. We were subjugated to them. Those two things were the strongest in Eretz Mitzrayim. But we were in Mitzrayim 430 years. We left the land of Egypt at the end of the 430 years because we were in the land of Egypt 210 years. But we were in Mitzrayim. We were tzekvetched and narrow. It's interesting. What's the opposite of min hametzar karasika, from the narrowness and constraint and constriction? Anani, God answers us, b'merchav yo, wide open. If Eretz Mitzrayim is the place where the Mitzrayim is the most intense, where is the place where the merchav, the wide open, is the most intense? Eretz Yisrael is called what? Eretz Tova or Rechava. Wide land. Didn't it ever bother you when you bench that Eretz Yisrael is a wide land? Wider than what? It's not wider than Rhode Island. What kind of wide land? I remember I was a tourist here once, 2 years before we moved here. We came here as tourists. I remember we were in a cab in the Kvish HaMahir. It was 1981. So the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway only went from Jerusalem-Tel Aviv. That was it. And it had four lanes, two on each side. So we were in the cab, and the cab driver was looking back at us the whole time, which was amazing to me, how he could drive like that. And he's telling us, you're Americans, right? I could see you speaking English, you're American. And he said, tell me the truth. In America, they have roads this wide? I couldn't resist. I said, yes, we do. We call them one-way streets. And that was the end of his conversation. What kind of wide land? I'll tell you what's wide. I was once at an Israeli shliach who was in America for a few months. He had to drive me from Brooklyn. He had to drive me from Brooklyn to Staten Island. So you have to go over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. Before you get on that bridge, there are like two or three expressways that converge. There's about 10 lanes on each side. So it's Friday afternoon. This Israeli is supposed to be driving me. Well, just before we get to the bridge, he stops the car in the middle of the road. So I said, what's the problem? We have car trouble? He said, no. I made a wrong turn. I'm in a parking lot, and I'm trying to figure out how to get out of it. I said, it's not a parking lot. This is the road. He never saw a road that wide in his life. So how does the Torah have the chutzpah to call Eretz Yisrael Eretz Rechava? But just like Mitzrayim is not a narrow land physically, but it's a place where you feel narrow. It's a place where there's a Yetzer Hara and there's Shibud Malchios. Eretz Yisrael is a place where you can really feel open. There the Yetzer Hara is less, and there we're not Meshubah to other nations, ideally. That's the idea. So that's the case. It says another Bechol Dor Vador. It says, in every generation, a person should consider himself as if he went out of Mitzrayim. There's another Bechol Dor Vador in the Haggadah. She Bechol Dor Vador Omdim Aleinu L'Chalosein. Every generation has its Shibud Mitzrayim. It was just the archetype of all the Galios to come. And every generation has its Yitzias Mitzrayim. And every individual has his own personal Mitzrayim and his own personal freedom from Mitzrayim. Everybody has constraints, constriction. It doesn't say that you have to consider yourself like you went out of Eretz Mitzrayim, but out of Mitzrayim. Chayiv Adam Liros Esatzma Kil Yotzom Ni Mitzrayim. And the Pasuk doesn't say Eretz Mitzrayim. It says, Bavur Zeh Asa Hashem Li B'Tzeisi Ni Mitzrayim, not Eretz Mitzrayim. You have to feel emotionally, Pesach night, your own personal Mitzrayim. What are the things that I know I would like to do differently, that really deep down I know I should be doing differently, and I can't because of the Yetzer Hara and because of outside influences? My Mitzrayim. You have to feel, Pesach night, that God gives you the ability to break the bonds of that Mitzrayim and be free. And then work on it the rest of the year. So you don't have to imagine like you're in the land of Egypt with Paro. I don't know what Paro looks like. I don't know what the land of Egypt looks like. You have to consider emotionally your own personal Mitzrayim, the Mitzrayim of your generation, and feel that this night you have the ability to be free. So three levels. The first level is intellectually, by speaking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, creating that unbroken chain, and realizing that intellectually it must be true, because it'd be very hard to falsify something that supposedly happened in front of an entire nation, like we explained. So the first level of feeling that it's real, not that you were actually there, but if you can identify with the people who were there because it's real to you, is intellectually. The second way is through your neshama. By doing the mitzvahs, you connect your neshama into the memory, the collective memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim that exists in that time zone, and it flows into your neshama. And thirdly, emotionally, to imagine your own personal Mitzrayim and your ability to be free of it. If you do those three things, you fulfill that mitzvah. You don't have to actually feel like you were a slave and be taken out. It works on these three levels. And if you did the mitzvahs properly, your neshama is charged up, mamish, with that collective memory, whether you feel it or you don't feel it, it's there, just like you don't see the battery charged, but it's charged. And the mitzvahs you do the whole year come from a charged neshama, which has to be again recharged in the coming year. That is the mitzvah of Chayiv Adam Liros Esatzmo on all of these three levels. If your mamish feel like you were a slave in Egypt, but it's not very nice. But really, you're mekayim it in these three ways, and therefore, if you did it properly, and you spoke about it properly, and you thought about it on your own properly, and you did the mitzvahs, then you fulfilled that mitzvah. You fulfilled the idea of Chayiv Adam Liros Esatzmo, and you don't have to feel frustrated and disappointed. If you can say Chaser Sidl Pesach Kil Chos, you did what you're supposed to do, then you fulfill that idea of charging your neshama, intellectually understanding it, and if you added a little bit of your own emotion, then that's the mitzvah.